We learned about the different courageous resistors to the apartheid system. We learned about the movement, as well as its dissenting voices, that eventually toppled apartheid. We heard several jaw-dropping, awe-inspiring stories about the Archbishop himself. And through it all, the Arch, as we affectionately called him, wove his understandings of God and his understandings of the theology of humanity. It sounds like heavy stuff. However, somehow, in each of the Arch's classes, we all left feeling like we had been bathed in God's love. My classmates and I always agreed that the sum of each lecture was this: you are God's beloved. In fact, in one of our classes, he must have repeated this several times, because when I look back in my notebook, I have written only for that day, "You are God's beloved. You are God's beloved. You are God's beloved." And how I wish that I could say that with the same accent as the Arch and with that same piercing stare he would use to meet our faces. It humbled me that I was receiving such a sermon from this particular man, one who had borne the insults of racism and oppression on his body and his spirit, and had united voices to subvert and transform this oppression. I mean, what had I done to merit such a man calling me God's beloved? But I must say, to have a starting point of being God's beloved is a good way to begin a spiritual journey. Knowing that we are loved inspires goodness. This love invites a relationship to love God back with our actions and with our lives. For me, having God's love as a starting point for a spiritual journey, rather than a sense of utter unworthiness, sets the trajectory or direction for how this collaboration with God will go. And while human love may be flawed and may even at times fail us, God's love is a love that will never let us go. First impressions matter. And this scene of Jesus getting baptized by John at the Jordan River is our first exposure in Matthew's gospel to the adult Jesus. I suppose John must have felt humbled too when Jesus asked John to baptize him. "Shouldn't you be baptizing me?" John asked Jesus. But Jesus tells John, "Let it be so now, for it is proper for us to fulfill all righteousness." Now, most of us would figure that Jesus was already a pretty righteous guy, blameless even. But as African-American preacher and activist Brad Braxton points out, righteousness doesn't just point to one's status in direct relationship to God. The Greek word for righteousness, dikaiosyn, can also be translated as justice, Braxton says. Righteousness encapsulates God's passionate commitment to set right the things that are wrong. Another meaning I see in Jesus receiving baptism from John is that these two men, whose mothers were cousins and friends, and who had not even been born before they were introduced in the womb, when Elizabeth felt her stomach leap in the presence of the newly pregnant Mary. They would both preach a message that would ultimately cost them their lives as they threatened the religious and political powers of their time. Water, which we see in scriptures as both the giver and the destroyer of life, is not always tame. Water is something when we choose to come to the font or present our children to the font of baptism, water helps us embark on a journey that could call us or our children to anything and everything. All we can be certain of is this: at the moment of baptism, God names us as God's son, as God's daughter, God's beloved, and that love continues no matter what storm or drought may find us. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. prophesied to the precious, beloved nature of all God's children. He taught in his letter from a Birmingham jail that whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. That conviction led King and those who boldly marched with him to endure the high-pressure jets of fire hoses as they fought for equity between the races and for economic justice. Some, including King, were hospitalized by the power of those fire hoses. But just as that water hospitalized, it also baptized society's understanding in transformative and remarkable ways. The televised news reports showing young activists attacked with fire hoses and with dogs created a moral turning point for many. And in one situation in Birmingham, Alabama, when a crowd of over 1,000 students knelt in prayer before the Birmingham jail that housed Martin Luther King, the police commander insisted his men turn on the fire hoses, aiming at the children and youth. Nobody moved. The commissioner yelled at them again, demanding that they follow his orders. Instead, these civil servants dropped their hoses. One fireman, with tears in his eyes, cried, "We can't continue to do this." Once we see our neighbors, whether they look like us or not, as God's beloved, we have a mandate for how we treat them. We must treat them as we would Jesus Christ, as if he were in our midst. I grew up in the South and am an heir to the legacy of racism. Like Martin Luther King, I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, but my birth came 8 years after King's assassination in Memphis. From the time I was in preschool, I remember learning about King's dream of living into God's beloved community here on earth, not just waiting for it in a time to come. I grew up to believe that hope for King's dream was part of what it means to be an American. Even though I was beginning to see that combating racism was not on everyone's agenda, I assumed that most Americans were in agreement that the general values King established are standard fare that decent people would at least pay lip service to. Are there fewer decent people today? Or is standing up for racial justice no longer a measure of decency? In the last years, months, and even days, we have seen the legitimizing of the white supremacist alt-right as a viable political force. Our president-elect has dismissed as talk, 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 and sad the legacy of U.S. House Representative John Lewis, whose head was bashed and skull fractured by police while taking part in peaceful demonstrations during the civil rights movement, I see in this country a racism unleashed that I find truly frightening, because it threatens any of my black or brown sisters and brothers in Jesus Christ, it also threatens me. Just as Jesus was submerged in the same waters of John the Baptist, together we are God's beloved. I cannot sit passively while others' rights are threatened beneath the smokescreen of a Twitter feed. So I am actually going to march in Washington, D.C. next Saturday with others in witness to the America I want to see. When I was picking hymns for this Sunday, I was surprised that I didn't gravitate toward the usual peace and justice freedom songs that define the civil rights movement. I love these songs. But instead, I chose as our closing hymn, "Precious Lord, Take My Hand." This was said to be King's favorite hymn, and it was the one that he requested as he was waiting on the motel balcony for his friends to get ready, as he called out to the saxophonist, Ben Branch, to play it real pretty for the meeting later that night. Moments later, he was shot and killed. We are God's beloved. And while God's love is not a gift that can be earned, it is also a gift that asks a huge responsibility of us. There is no telling where the waters of baptism will lead us. But have courage, beloved ones. We can count on God to take our hand in leading us there. Thanks be to God. Amen.